All right, the Senate Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. I'm Senator Latz, Vice Chair of the Committee. Pleasure to chair the committee today while Senator Higgins, our chair, has a number of bills before the committee. So, welcome. And today is Monday, February 19, 2007. And do you have any preference what order we take the bills up in, or should we just follow the agenda?
Mr. Chair, why don't we do Senate File 815? Well, let's just do them in order. 815 first, the police officer grants and overtime.
Okay. Senate File number 815 is in front of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to start out with an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. And members, this amendment would specify that the commissioner, in giving out the grants to assist the law enforcement agencies, will do it to the agencies in greatest needs in terms of personnel demands and crime rates.
Okay, so Senator Higgins, I just want to notify the members that the amendment is in your folders. So it's not being handed out separately. And you move your amendment?
Yes, sir.
Are there any questions of the author on the amendment? Is there any discussion? Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. A1 is added to the bill.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and members, this bill is quite simple. It appropriates $2.5 million each year of the biennium for grants to local units of government to hire new peace officers under an existing program that is laid out there in lines 1.9. The second part of it then also gives $2.5 million each year for grants to local units of government for overtime pay for peace officers. We have at least three chiefs that I know about here, and if they would come up to the table, I'm going to let the men in blue do the talking. Deputy Chief Rob Allen from Minneapolis, Chief Harrington from St. Paul, and Chief Sutter, who we heard from the other day from Brooklyn Park. Everybody would just pull up a chair. We'll.
Chiefs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins, do you have any preferred order, or have the chiefs conferred and decided who will start?
You guys talked about who wants to start?
No.
Okay. All right.
We'll let the biggest city start, so.
All right. Would you please state your full name for the record?
I'm Deputy Chief Rob Allen. I'm the Deputy Chief in charge of the Patrol Bureau for the City of Minneapolis. And it's a privilege to testify on behalf of this bill. The one thing I want senators to be aware of is the real value that we're getting out of overtime dollars in policing. There's a lot of talk, and actually our city has done a fairly good job of hiring new police officers. But hiring police officers is a time-consuming process. And if we agree today to hire police officers, we will not have effective, active police officers on the street trained and ready to do their job for another year to year and a half. It takes that long to do hiring, background checks, and to put officers on the street. We used a tremendous amount of overtime last year in the city of Minneapolis with great success. State money was used in downtown Minneapolis, and we partnered with other agencies which have jurisdiction in the city of Minneapolis, including the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, the Minnesota State Patrol, and the Metropolitan Transit Police. In the second precinct, which is northeast Minneapolis, we also partnered with officers from the University of Minnesota Police Department. And that allowed us to use Minneapolis officers in those areas of Minneapolis which were experiencing very high violent crime. But we used officers from those other agencies to deal with areas which they really specialized in as well. Downtown Minneapolis gets a lot of special events traffic from the Target Center, from the Metrodome, from the Convention Center. And having officers who are used from a variety of agencies used to serving those clientels that are in town for those events has been very effective. So we use that money to hire those officers from those other agencies, and the result was a fairly precipitous drop in crime in downtown Minneapolis last year, and proved to be very effective. So we look forward to the opportunity to do that again.
Thank you. Chief Harrington.
Senator, members of the committee, I'm also here today to testify in support of this bill. We've also in St. Paul had a great success with using overtime dollars to supplement our existing overtime budget. And I would just point out, once again, last summer and even this fall, within the shadow of the Capitol, we saw tremendous response from overtime dollars in what we called our grid project, which was right up the block at 175 Charles. Literally just off of Marion and University Avenue, where we recovered multiple pounds of marijuana, multiple weapons, made well over 140 arrests within a month time of an overtime detail. The reason this detail was so effective was that it was not simply doing the reactive policing that we're staffed to do. It allowed officers, because they were on overtime, to not be tied to the 911 monster, which said you always have to be in your car and ready to go to the next call. It allowed them to stay out handling calls and building relationships and building information. The project was a great success, and in fact, I would attribute most of the success last year in St. Paul in reducing crime to the overtime details that we had, both on the west side, on Rice Street, and on the east side. All of those projects that we did last year were, in fact, overtime details, and we could not have done them if we did not have the money. In order for us to get the money, normally what we have to do is we have to hold vacancies open, which means we don't hire cops. That is really a two-edged sword. By not hiring cops, what we end up doing is we end up shorting ourselves on longer-term investigations. We short ourselves in non-peak times. Last summer, for example, I essentially dismantled the traffic unit. At a time when you would think you would have the most traffic with all the vacationers and all the folks in downtown St. Paul and all the parks here, we dismantled the traffic unit because we could not handle the surge in 911 calls without taking bodies off of what we were essentially secondary assignments, traffic, problem properties. Those areas grew. Parking, traffic, DUIs, things along those lines grew because we did not have people paying attention to them. So we are here to support both the grants towards hiring additional cops and also the overtime grants.
Chief Sutter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for inviting me to testify today. I want to just provide a little different perspective on the issue that both Chief Allen and Chief Harrington spoke about. This is a real need, and it's based because crime is a problem in our communities, and it's not just a problem in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I can tell you that between 1994 and the year 2004 in Brooklyn Park, our overall crime rate dropped 16.5%. In 2005, that rate rose 5%. We believe the numbers in 2006 to be about 6 to 7% increase. That's not the only problem, though. It's really the trend towards violent crime, and we need cops to deal with that. In Brooklyn Park in 2006, we went from 83 armed robberies in 2005 to 158 in 2006. That's a 92% increase in 1 year. Our department is nowhere near as big as Minneapolis-St. Paul. We have 89 sworn officers, but we need more police officers. And to be quite frank with you, some of the reductions in government aid over the last 5 years have really hurt us. Brooklyn Park is a community that is the sixth largest city in Minnesota with a population of about 72,000 people, but our assessed valuation is approximately less than half of what a lot of the surrounding communities are, such as Plymouth, Maple Grove, Eden Prairie, or even Bloomington. Our ability to put police officers on the street is limited by our assessed valuation and our ability to raise taxes, and it is a real problem. Now, we use overtime also, and interesting, as Chief Harrington was testifying, just recently we added 7 officers last week. And 4 of those are additional this year. They're all general fund born. But we have a turnover issue going on, too. Throughout our agencies, approximately in Brooklyn Park, 30% of our police department is eligible to retire this year. They will all retire within 5 years. Every one of our agencies is seeing a huge component of that as the end of the baby boomer generation comes through the law enforcement profession. Interestingly enough, we've had to dismantle our traffic unit and our street crimes unit just to train these new officers. It's very labor intensive. We can, through the course of overtime, and if certainly we can use state assistance in just adding new officers. We know now, and we're meeting now with the other suburbs in the northern Hennepin County area, that we are going to try and add 20 police officers over the next 3 years. An average police officer is about $75,000 to $80,000. That is a huge burden on us at the general fund. And in our community, public safety consumes about 50% of our local budget. When we are committed to fighting these huge crime increases we've experienced, it is a problem. I would just add with a different spin on the overtime. Some of you may be familiar with a double homicide that occurred in our community about 4 weeks ago. I just want to share with you that overtime, that case alone has cost our city and my department over $50,000 in overtime. We executed 24 search warrants. We arrested criminals in three different states, utilized two different FBI offices, and the complexity of the crime we're dealing with far exceeds any of our ability to meet it. And whether it's Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park, St. Cloud, or Bloomington, it really doesn't matter. Thank you.
Senator Higgins, or any questions of the witnesses? Yeah. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, are any of your witnesses, I understand that there is a role for overtime to play, but when you pay overtime to, you know, generate 1 hour of police time, does it cost more than it would if you were able to hire another officer to fulfill those responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, one of the reasons that overtime is valuable is that it allows you more flexibility with the officers you have. And the problem is to put, say, five additional officers on the street at one time, you'd need approximately 11 officers, full-time to ensure that there would be five officers at that peak time because they're scheduled at different times of the week. And they get days off and that sort of thing. To do focused enforcement at those specific times and places when crime is occurring and not just responding to 911 calls, overtime is a far more effective and less expensive tool than having officers working at straight time.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins and Deputy Chief Allen, I did say that I believe there is a role for overtime to play. So that wasn't my question. My question was, if you're just comparing 1 hour of police officer coverage and you're paying for it with overtime versus if you could hire a new officer, what is the overtime more costly?
No. Chief Al?
Sure. Chief. Senator Berglund, Mr. Chair, an overtime hour costs 1.5 times by our contract, and I think pretty much by any contract, costs 1.5 times more than an officer working at straight time. It may be even more than that. If you do the math, a more experienced officer has a slightly higher hourly wage than a new officer. So it may be more than 1.5 times what it would cost for a new officer. But again, the challenge and the reason that overtime is so important is because it allows us to put officers to respond to a surge in crime, which our standard staffing doesn't allow us to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
And Senator Higgins and Deputy Chief Allen, I understand that. And I understand that there is a role for overtime to play. For example, Chief Harrington's example of this special unit they created, if you could create those special units, without using overtime by filling in behind those officers that have that experience with regular officers, then I guess my preference would be that you would do that because, again, if we can make the dollars go farther, I think all of us that, believe me, anybody who lives in a crime area, the biggest thing that we hear about is the length of time it takes to answer a call or the things that are going on in their community that people see over and over again and they don't see any police presence about those things. So, I would hope we would be able to eventually be able to fund this area well enough so that we wouldn't have to be using overtime as much as we do now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the first part of the bill is a bill for hiring new officers, and it's to fund an existing program that we have that are, Mr. Turner can probably say this better than I can, but they are three-year grants. You know, what we always know about giving grants to the local governments for hiring new people is that there's a cliff if we don't, keep helping them with the cost of that until they can, get their budgets such that they can absorb that themselves. A great example was the Clinton cops. I think Minneapolis had 80 Clinton cops, and we just fell off a cliff when the federal government stopped funding them. I thought that it was appropriate to put these two together in one bill because we know that both of these tools will help our local governments. And, it really much depends on what the target of this division will be, on how much we can do, whether we can do one, whether we can do both, whether we can make it flexible enough so that we can help them out however we can. I just think that we really do need to help with the rising crime problem, and this is, I think, is a good tool to do it.
Senator Berglund, a follow-up.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I understand that part of your bill, and I'm glad that you funded permanent positions as well in your bill. But we all know that if you don't get a grant for the permanent position, but you get a grant for the overtime, then you'll be paying overtime. And so that's my only concern, is that we make sure we have the appropriate amount of money in each pot to meet the need, and that we are encouraging the hiring of officers where we can to make sure we have an adequate, men and women on the job, but also, that we have new people coming up and getting that experience so that they can take on those tougher cases later on. And I'm assuming, Senator Higgins, that you're putting this in the base, in your bill, so these grants would continue more than on a three-year cycle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that would be my plan.
Senator Foley?
You can defer it.
Senator Ingram.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that was my question. The hiring of police officers, if this was going to be an ongoing thing where the city's going to keep those officers once they're hired under this particular bill. But I understand it's your intention to come back with more bill after 2009. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, I'm hoping that we will get a budget for our division that will allow us to do that. It's just got to be a high priority for us, in my way of thinking. Like the cliff.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'm concerned about, Senator Higgins, is we're going to a new type of funding using state funds to fund things in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I don't see any support for my communities, Brooklyn Park and the other Northwest Side people. And the question is, what are we going to do there when the enhanced enforcement effort in Minneapolis causes people to move out into our communities? And how are we going to pay for that?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Foley, I think that's why I was invited to testify, just for that reason. We do believe that some of the focused enforcement efforts in Minneapolis over the past year have impacted us. I've spent a lot of time with Chief Allen, Chief Dolan, over the last few months talking about what we're seeing and very much why we're in support of this. I was glad to see the amendment that does put a standard down with regard to staffing needs and crime rates. I'm confident, unfortunately, that my community would rise to the top of that in the suburban environment. But I think that's an important component, because to put the money in the communities where we're not seeing increased crime is clearly a problem. And if our goal is to suppress crime, I think supporting the agencies that are having the most difficult time putting the staff on the street is really important.
Senator Ingebretson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. I understand where Senator Foley's coming from. This is statewide funding, is that correct? If somebody in Roseau, Minnesota can come up with a statistic that they need help, or I may say even the WeFest situation over in Detroit Lakes area, they would qualify for this type of funding. So it's not just the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrecht, that would be correct.
Yeah, thank you.
And it would also be police departments as well as sheriff's departments.
Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins, first of all, I want to thank you for your leadership in putting this bill together. But I do want to share with the members of this committee, too, in that sometimes we have to kind of piecemeal together solutions where we can. And here in this committee, we're trying to respond to, I think, a larger issue and larger concern, which is that, you know, from my standpoint, I'd much rather we put money into the base of the local municipalities so that they can take care of public safety. And for a long, long time, we've not done that. And namely, I mean, the disinvestment in local municipalities in the form of taking away LGA, I believe that that's where a lot of cities have gotten the greatest hit, is in public safety. Now, while I disagree with the governor and his proposal, and it's sounding like, you know, I'm a member of the tax committee, so it's sounding like I'm taking us to that discussion, I disagree with tying the hands of local municipalities in terms of any kind of local government aid that they may be getting. But I'll tell you that I think that if we were to talk about public safety and where the needs of public safety have come in and where many, many local municipalities have had to cut corners or have to stay lean where they really needed to bulk up has been because I think we've not been as helpful in giving them reliable and predictable resources at the federal level so that they can make those kind of decisions at the local level. So, you know, I mean, this issue is important, and I certainly hope, Senator Higgins, that you will have the money in your budget to fund this and to fund it at the base. But I also hope that beyond this committee that, you know, we all think as participants here at the legislature about other arenas. I mean, we wouldn't have to be resorting to putting money into grants if we would be willing to fund local municipalities at the bigger level or in the bigger picture. So, I mean, this is a trade-off. And I feel like we're forced to do this because we have to when we do have other options to be helping our public safety departments to do things in a different and better way by putting money into their base instead of hoping we can continue to put money into your base in this committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's anybody else in the audience who wants to speak on this.
Well, let's find out. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak on this?
If not, Mr. Chair, I move that this be laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill, or whatever that motion is I'm supposed to make.
Consider that just fine.
Good.
Madam Chair.
It was something like that.
All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
All right. Thank you.
Senate File 815 is laid over for consideration.
And Mr. Chair, while we have all the chiefs here, could we move to the squad car camera technology grants, Senate File 812?
All right, before the committee, is Senate File 812. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, this is an appropriation of $2 million each year to replace the obsolete cameras that are in the squad cars. Those of us who've been around for a little while may remember that when we did the racial profiling bill, and I can't remember what year that was, but part of the agreement for getting the racial profiling bill passed was grants to the local governments to put in cameras in the squad car. And at the time, I think there were a lot of police departments who felt that these would be very useful in the he said sort of discussions that go on with allegations of abuse, allegations of whatever. And I believe that they have been a hugely successful tool to the departments that have them in their squad cars. I do know, however, that their VCR quality tapes, is that correct?
VHS,
that's the word. And the world has gone to digital. And so I think this would be a good way that we can help those departments stay current with their technology and continue to use them as the tool that we envision them to do and more. And the chiefs can give you lots more information, I think.
Chief Allen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, thank you very much. Again, the in-squad video has been a remarkable tool for the Minneapolis Police Department. It has saved us from major expenses in terms of lawsuits in which we were able to show that officers acted appropriately. It has been a good tool in terms of training our officers in appropriate response to calls. The challenge, and while the technology is excellent and we'd like to expand the program, the real challenge is the management of the data that's recorded by those in-squad video cameras. Each of our five precincts now has sort of the equivalent of a Blockbuster store of videotapes stored in cabinets. We store that data for 90 days, and the challenge is that those VHS tapes store 8 hours of data, and that 8 hours is not an entire shift. It may be several shifts by several different officers on one tape, and then that, and trying to find a two-minute incident in an eight-hour tape in a cabinet of several thousand tapes is a remarkable challenge. And it's a challenge that's there's technology allows us to eliminate that challenge. The technology is digital cameras, and it's either digital that can be recorded on a CD, which is searchable, or DVD, which is searchable, or can be uplinked electronically, wirelessly, so there are no moving parts in the squad car to break down and that type of thing. As we move forward, it will allow us to spend a lot more time doing policing than being records clerks and trying to find, you know, sometimes a needle in a haystack, a 1 or 2 minute encounter in thousands and thousands of tapes.
Chief Harrington.
Senator, members of the committee, I'm also here to testify on behalf of this bill. I can tell you really two key issues. Number one, I meet regularly with the NAACP, African American Leadership Council, and other members of communities of color. And the discussion about racial profiling, while it has sort of went moribund for a short period of time, is reemerging. I believe due to some of the very high-profile cases involving individuals of color, and the enhanced enforcement activities of both Minneapolis, St. Paul, and now the suburban agencies, this issue is going to come back, and it's going to come back in many ways, probably far broader than it was initially, as the Somali community, the Hispanic community, and other communities will now join in with the black community with concerns about racial profiling or driving while black or driving while brown. So I am very much in support of this. I believe when this bill came out initially, it was the right direction for the state to go, and I think it was a mistake for agencies that did not take advantage of it at that time. I also share Deputy Chief Allen's concern about recovering data. It is an incredible needle in a haystack to try and recover that one fragment of data that you need to block a civil lawsuit, an internal affairs investigation, or to head off a major community disruption. And that's really what we're talking about in some cases. The fact that you can bring out a video and show that the young man had a gun when the community is rife with rumors that the cops shot him unarmed is what stops riots in some cases. It is what stops community disruption. And so I think this is great technology. The faster we can get that evidence out into the community and out into the public hands, the better off we are.
Chief Sutter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to testify on this bill as one of those agencies that did not participate in the racial profiling study because we'd had the cameras for 5 years before that. And I was disappointed in the original legislation that the only incentive to participate was the fact that the state would provide a grant for cameras. I can tell you that after 30 years in law enforcement, 12 years as a police chief, this is probably the most effective tool we have in managing our people. Because I believe very strongly that the overwhelming majority of police officers in this state do things the right way. They don't racially profile and everything else. But we are in a state and age of multimedia, particularly with the generation, our children and so forth, and being able to show people what's going on is important. Our agency in just in the last 3 years has had 5 federal lawsuits dismissed solely because of the video and the cameras. I had one of my captains meet with meet with a prominent Minneapolis civil rights leader about 2 years ago on a complaint of racial profiling. We were able to put the tape in the captain's VCR, play it back, and that complaint was gone instantly. In fact, that individual said it's the first time in 20 years that he's had an agency provide them with video of the incident before an investigation has even begun. I can tell you that it's an expensive technology, VHS tapes. Most of us don't have VCRs in our homes anymore. The storage is huge. I've got a garage full of tapes that we keep, and it's very labor-intensive to go back and find those snippets of a video of four or five different cars that are needed for prosecution in many cases, from a fleeing charge, a police chase, and so forth. But they're about $5,000 a unit, the cameras are. And then you need a wireless network or a backbone infrastructure, about another $20,000. In Brooklyn Park, we have 35 patrol vehicles that have these units. You can do the math. That's about $200,000 to replace that system, and we need to do it. We've talked about it this year. Again, we're making choices about police officers versus technology. That's a terrible choice to have to make because this technology does help us do our jobs better and does reduce our litigation costs, clearly.
Mr. Chair, the
Senator Higgins.
Everybody's alluded to the VHS technology. There are flash drives around now that you can store in them. You know, it'll be like this big, and just the difference in the storage capability of that little bitty flash drive and a VHS tape. I said it right? Right.
Yeah, that's correct.
is just going to be amazing. Not to mention the quality of the tape will be superior, and as Senator Moi said earlier, we've made our local governments skinny down, and they are having to make choices that are very uncomfortable choices for them. You know, do we get more officers, or do we try and replace some of the technology? And this is one thing that I think that we can do to help out our local units of government, and I hope that you would support it.
Senator Moi.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, you know, I have to share with you that I think at the beginning of the legislative session, there was an unfortunate incident in Minneapolis where a young Minnesotan of Hmong American descent got involved in an incident with the Minneapolis police, and he was shot. And the family members were very, very extremely upset, and they felt like somehow, you know, he might have been profiled. And I think that there was going to be a big protest in downtown Minneapolis. And I have to tell you, I got on the phone with Chief Dolan, and I said, if there's any way you can show them anything to let them know that this was not anything that the families need to be concerned about in terms of racial profiling. And I think the chief made the decision to pull out the tape. And now, this wasn't a tape that was in a Minneapolis police car, but fortunately, where the incident took place, I think it was in the schoolyard where there was a camera, and they were able to show the tape. And I think that really brought down the level of discussion on the incident. It really brought the family into the fold to look at the situation. And I think overall it made the relationship between, you know, the community and the police department a whole lot better, because the members of the community were able to see for themselves what happened with the incident. So I have to tell you that sometimes from my standpoint of sometimes, you know, dealing with a community who very much always feels like they are at the other end or are victimized, this kind of information is very helpful in helping to build bridges and repair relationships.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Chief Setter, you said the infrastructure was quite costly. Can you go through that for me? What would each department have to have? A whole new technology? I mean, how much money are we going to spend on the infrastructure versus the cameras?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, what you're talking about is looking at some sort of digital storage medium, probably a server and a wireless network. That's one of the most prominent technologies now. Now I have to pay to store tapes. And I probably have 300 or 400 square feet of storage space, which has a cost to it, to store tapes. And so once you put in a computer server, a wireless network, it's about $15,000 to $20,000. I have to tell you, my department's looked at every single vendor that's available in the United States over the last 2 years. I've been at probably two dozen meetings in the last year and a half trying to identify the best technology, and that appears to be the best thing today. Once you do it, though, it's just a matter of maintaining the server, but I'm not paying to store tapes in a heated garage, for example, which has a cost to it, too.
Chief Sutter, I would hope the audio becomes a little more reliable than the existing VHS systems, too. I'm seeing heads nodding there. I've reviewed lots of law enforcement videotapes, and half the time, if there is audio, it's pretty hard to decipher.
Mr. Chair, I think we'd all agree, having looked at these, the weakest link in the system is definitely the audio, because as we upgrade the video component, that technology, it seems like everybody uses the same microphone system. And even though the unit's $5,000, the microphone system you can buy for about $200. And that's definitely something that needs to work on. And believe me, I've had that discussion with every vendor I've talked to. It is difficult, though. You have to remember, you're using equipment that's typically designed for home use in a very heavy-duty industrial environment. And the officers carrying these on their belt, it's subject to all sorts of climatic conditions, certainly just the wear and tear of taking it off and on every day. I don't know of too many professions that wear a microphone for 8 to 12 hours a day and have it survive. So we are aware of that issue, and I agree with you 100%.
If I might also ask any of the witnesses, the issue of racial profiling obviously has its own dimensions, but one of them is the having officers of color that reflect the community, so there's a little bit less suspicion even to start with when there's some interaction. Any sense of where your departments are in balancing that equation?
Mr. Chair, I can speak for the Minneapolis Police Department. We've never had a higher percentage of officers of color than we do right now. We've had remarkable success because of initiatives that we're doing even in the high schools in recruiting officers of color who do reflect far better the diversity of the city of Minneapolis. And through the CSO program, community service officer program, and cadet programs, the percentage of officers of color who are coming through our academies is far higher than it's ever been in the past.
Senator, members of the committee, reflecting on St. Paul, and we're hiring in about 2 weeks. We have set a goal, and we have met it for this year, of hiring at least 40% of every class will be individuals of color and women. And we've been able to meet that with this class. I can tell you that it took some extraordinary recruiting efforts, which, frankly, we pale in comparison with Minneapolis, which has a 17-person recruiting team that's been going out and beating us to the punch on a number of places. And despite that, we still got our 40%. Our secondary effort to that is to require a bilingual officer so that even when we are not hiring officers of color, at least we have officers who have a real well-grounded background in the cultures that they'll be serving.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to commend my colleagues because I can say in the suburbs I don't think we're having the same degree of success. And part of which I think they've alluded to, there's a tremendous amount of recruiting and competition going on for qualified candidates of color. We have probably out of 85 officers in Brooklyn Park Police Department, I have I think 6 or 7 of color, probably 14 women. We do better in recruiting women. However, the group I just hired last week of 7, I can tell you that I hired 100% of the minority and female candidates I interviewed, which was none. And there is a tremendous competition. The front end on the candidate pool is very, very shallow. There is a humongous a tremendous shortage of qualified candidates, period, regardless of gender or ethnicity, to be quite candid with you, and we have to work very hard. I can tell you, though, we have a cadet program and a community service program that is funded through our Joint Community Police Project with Brooklyn Center, which is an immigration and immigrant outreach program, and we've hired two Hmong community service officers, a Hmong cadet, and it's working very well. So we think on that end to get these qualified candidates in on the front end, find that working in the suburbs does have the same advantages as it does in the major city, and the reality of it is, as our communities transition, I think that will become less of an issue.
Senator Foley?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, and maybe the others, what is the status now of the community cameras that are on the poles and that sort of thing? I suppose Minneapolis is the only one that has those other than the freeway tapes.
Chief Allen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, we have had an initial installation of about 28 of those cameras in downtown Minneapolis through funding from the private sector. But since then, because they've been proven remarkably successful, we've been able to increase the number of those cameras. We have approximately 40 in the first precinct, which is downtown Minneapolis, but to include the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. The community itself funded a large part of those cameras. That also happened in the third precinct in South Minneapolis along Bloomington Avenue, Lake Street, 38th and Chicago, again, largely from community support. We're in the process, Mayor Rybeck made increasing the police camera technology a priority. We're in the process of installing a camera system in North Minneapolis, which will be about 50 cameras in the hardest in the area hardest hit by crime in North Minneapolis. Those cameras will be online by this summer. So by the end of this year, we'll be well over 100 cameras, and I suspect that that trend will continue in Minneapolis.
Senator Foley, members of the committee, St. Paul is in the early stages. We have a public grant from the Department of Transportation, and we expect we will have cameras up on the in the Midway area, down University Avenue, and into downtown St. Paul by Thanksgiving of this year. We expect we'll have approximately 50 cameras there by the end of this year, and by the time of the RNC, we hope to have in the neighborhood of 75 to 100 cameras blanketing the downtown area and the Midway area. That's at least that's the proposal right now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, we don't have any, but I can tell you that we have a number of neighborhoods that we could use them, and that's really a conclusion we've reached in the last 18 months with our increasing crime. We have some neighborhoods where remote monitoring would be tremendously beneficial as a crime suppression technology. But, again, it's a matter of, you know, assigning priorities to the limited dollars available.
Senator Foley,
Mr.
a follow-up?
Chairman, on that, if you got a priority between those cameras and the car material, what would be your choice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, clearly the car cameras. They're out there every day for us doing the day-to-day thing in the suburbs. It may be different for the city, but they support our officers so much and really are a great tool for making them safe.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, just I would echo Chief Sutter's comment. Nobody is a bigger supporter of public safety video camera systems than I am, and the pole cameras. I've been involved in development of several of them, but they, in importance, they pale in comparison to the squad car cameras. Yeah, those protect officers' lives, and they protect officers' financial well-being from lawsuits, from false allegations. And they're effective training tools and you know, allow us a greater degree of supervision of our officers. So I think they're far more important.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just let me wander off the subject just a little bit just for a point of interest, and you have the chiefs here. I'm sure you're familiar with the national SRO programs. Do you have any of those programs, and what do you think of those? Just for a point of interest for the
standing
group.
Standing room only?
Standing room only, that's right. Yeah.
School resource officer, I believe he's referring to.
School resource officer, full-time. Yeah.
The City of St. Paul has, at this time, 11 SROs. We are staffed in all of the senior high schools and in four of the junior high schools. When we are fully staffed, we have 17 SROs because it allows us to then also staff the alternative schools. And do more outreach to some of the troubled elementary schools where we're seeing as a pool where gang activity and gang recruitment is starting. We are very supportive of NASRO and those programs. We have hosted their training for the last few years, and we have found both the presence of SROs as a community policing tool and as a crime reduction tool been very, 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 very beneficial to the City of St. Paul.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Chief Sutter.
I am a significant fan of the SRO program. I really feel as government are one of our basic services we need to provide in law enforcement is to make our learning environment safe. We have four SROs in our community, two high schools, two junior high. I can tell you I've met with our four officers three or four times already since September, And there has been a tremendous transition that's taken place in some of our schools. And it's one of safety. There are more suspensions, more discipline action. It's taken in many of our schools in this community. Gang issues are a real issue, even in the suburbs. And we, in fact, are looking right now, and as part of our strategic planning, to put two officers, an additional officer in each of our high schools, simply because our high school SROs are making 4 to 5 custodial arrests a week for assaults and those types of things. And we are to the point where we're dealing with basic fundamental safety issues and to the point where we don't have the time to deal with the theft issues with iPods and cell phones and all of these very expensive electronics that our young adults bring into the high schools. They're stolen freely. But again, it's down to priority and safety, and there's a dramatic shift that's, I think, occurred in the last couple of years in many of our secondary schools.
Senator Foley?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and the Chief, I'm concerned with the vast increase of gang signs and tagging items. And I noticed that for a time there, we were getting removal of that pretty quickly, but now it's not happening. And I see that on the 94, 280, and that corridor over there where there's blocks all the way along there. It seemed to me your position was that was a priority item and that you needed to get those out of there, but that isn't happening. Is this something that could happen in the future?
Senator, members of the committee.
Chief Harrington.
Absolutely. I believe when we talk about graffiti, whether it's tagger graffiti, which is the graffiti vandals, or gang graffiti, one of the most important things we can do is to get that down as quickly as possible. There has been cuts in public works. I believe there's also been shifting of priorities with state transportation systems in terms of their public works. Getting it off of public property actually has been much more difficult than getting it off of private property in St. Paul. We've been very successful in St. Paul to get it off the private property and in the city-owned public property. Some other governmental agencies we've had a little more of a struggle with. But it is really important to get it off, because if it does not get off, what you end up with is layers. You end up with the Serenos marking up a piece of territory and claiming it as theirs, and the next gang that comes in takes that as a personal affront. And you end up as having conflicts over who has the most recent graffiti and who's going to protect their graffiti. And you end up with real people getting shot or assaulted because of the graffiti in those locations. So I'm a big proponent of trying to get it down as quickly as possible, record it, recognize it, and then go out and find the people that are putting it up and try and hold them accountable.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, last year you all helped the city of Minneapolis get a $2.5 million grant for summer jobs for Minneapolis kids. And we hired 1,400 kids last summer, and the Regulatory Services Inspections Department hired crews of kids to go and take out the graffiti in South Minneapolis. And you know, it's really tough to do, especially in the winter, to get the graffiti off because it's 20 below out there. But in the summer, the kids did a great job. You know, the department was very successful in outfitting a couple of, you know, kind of some of the cars that, you know, weren't really good for use by the inspectors anymore. You know, with the capabilities of carrying the paint and the crews that went out and worked, and they did a heck of a job for us.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of interest. In my other life as sheriff, we have a resource that's available to us to take care of graffiti. It's called Prisoners, and it works out very, very well, and always has. And actually, it was a very good program that we did. And our STS program did that. So for what it's worth, you may want to check with your local sheriff. You might have a few of those. Thanks.
Senator Higgins, how was the $2 million figure come up with? How far do you think that will go to address this problem?
Mr. Chair, it was a guess more than anything. When I asked Chief Dolan at Minneapolis what it would cost to change over the cars in Minneapolis, he thought about $500,000 for Minneapolis. So it truly was just a guess. I didn't. It was
I wouldn't have really known how to figure out how to put a good number in there. But again, if we can keep, if we can put this into the base when the time comes, you know, it'll be a resource that we can kind of spread from kind of far and wide. The chief, do you want to talk about that?
Chief Harrington.
Senator, I must admit it's a regret of mine, when I took over as chief was that the city of St. Paul, when the cameras were initially offered, had not taken advantage of that. And I have, subsequent to that, for the last 2 years, been seeking grant funding, private sector funding, and Chief Dolan's number of about $500,000 is right about accurate in terms of what it would take to outfit an entire department of a metro area size with the digital technology. The servers are cheaper, the cameras are more reliable. In St. Paul, we have not, other than a few isolated traffic cars that have them, we have not taken it. We were not able to take advantage of this at the time that it was offered. And so in St. Paul, this would really be the outfitting of the St. Paul Police Department's patrol division and specialty cars with the camera system rather than a replacement of the camera system.
Senator Higgins, maybe before we get into marking up an omnibus bill, it would be helpful to solicit some harder numbers from at least some of the larger departments that we expect might apply here to make sure
Mr.
we...
Mr. Chair, I'll see if I can figure out how to do that.
Let the word go forth.
If there are no other people who want to testify, and no more questions, I'll move that this bill be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
The motion has been made. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins, the next bill before us will be Senate File Number 417 on short-term offender costs.
Mr. Chair, you all have your budget books. If so, you might want to turn to pages, I guess starting page on 23 of the corrections tab. I'm talking while I'm shuffling paper here. I apologize. We've had quite a bit of discussion already about our issue of short-term offenders being housed in our county jails.
Hi, how are you?
I think at your seat you have a couple of articles, one called Inmate, Who's Got the Inmate? From, I think it was last week's City Pages. And what we know is that it costs the departments, the sheriff's departments, somewhere, depending on who you talk to, I've heard $40 a day, $45 a day, $50 a day, $75 a day, up to $130 was the most that somebody told me. It actually a real cost for housing the short-term offenders. We pay them $9 and something like 62 cents a day instead. So this bill would appropriate $6.5 million each fiscal year to reimburse the counties for the housing and care of the short-term offenders. We would put this in the base, and this amount of money would fully fund about 300 offenders at $56 a day. And then also remember that the funding in this section of law also pays for inpatient medical care for the short-term offenders. So if they're healthy in there, this is more that we can use to reimburse the counties. If they're not healthy, that's less. I think also at your places there is the 2003 report to the legislature on short-term offenders done by the Department of Corrections. There are a whole lot of people who can talk more about this than I can. And then Senator Olsen, where are you? Why don't you pull your chair up, too? Senator Olsen had a bill very similar to mine, but asking for a task force, I think, and if you'd want to talk about that.
Well, Senator Olsen, welcome to the committee.
It's a pleasure to be here. My bill actually had less dollars, so I'm glad to see this bill kind of replacing it. And I'm coming from county government, much as the sheriff's coming from former sheriff. So this was pretty near and dear to my heart, as our county was housing approximately 30 prisoners a day out of county, and our prices ranged from $50 to $55 to $80 a day. We were even housing some out of state. We had an agreement with a county in Wisconsin where some prisoners who signed a release would be sent over to Wisconsin to be housed. So I guess the point of it is that our jail is so full already, and then any prisoners we got from the state, we had to displace other prisoners, adding to the number of prisoners that were out of county. And it's correct that the $9 reimbursement did not go very far when we're housing them out of county at up to $80 a day. So I appreciate this bill, and I also appreciate the medical component, because when I went go through the county bills, the dental bills were unbelievable, and I don't think it was for polishing their teeth either. So I think that this is a very good bill that's going to help. Well, I think turned into quite a substantial shift to local property taxes, because counties have had to pick up the cost of these prisoners at much more than what they were being reimbursed. So that's about all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the department's budget this year proposes to increase the amount to $30 a day of reimbursement. This bill that Senator Olsen and I are, the bills that we are working on, would increase it more to the actual cost. And at this point, I think I will stop, and I don't know who wants to speak first. Jan, maybe?
I'd be happy to.
Ramsey County Commissioner Jan Parker is to my far left.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome,
Chair.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Senator Higgins and members of the committee, really appreciate this opportunity to come before you today to talk about our plight in county government regarding the short-term offenders. In 2003, you know, we all know that there were very, very serious budgetary pressures, and this was one of the ways that the state found to balance their budget, was to send some of the state prisoners to the county facilities. And I understand that the recommendation came with recommendation to pay the actual costs of the counties, and it still would save the state money. But somehow along the line in the budgeting process, the money was not budgeted to do that. And so what happened is we ended up getting the state offenders and paying for it with county money, which, as you know, is property tax. That's the only source of funding that we have. And so this went straight to the increase in the county property taxes. In Ramsey County, our cost for 2007 is $95 per day. And so you can see we have quite a gap in the actual, in how much we're having to pick up from the property taxes to pay for these state offenders. We expect to have about 61 short-term offenders per day in Ramsey County, totaling about 22,000. So far, since this change was made in 2003, we have spent about $4.9 million just in Ramsey County alone to house the state's felons. Another thing that has entered into this for us is that because our facility has a capacity of 316 beds, with an additional allowance or a variance to increase that by 48, which would when we can house them in this light industrial area. And we've had, because of the increase in the state offenders, we've had to use that space as well. And so one of the effects that we've also had is that we don't have the space to do training, and some of when these folks are getting ready to leave, they need to do some job search, and this is the same space now that we're having to house them in. And so we really do not have the room, you know, to provide adequate services for this group. I just really appreciate your willingness to reconsider this action that was taken in 2003. And if you are going to continue sending the offenders that only have, what happens is when they get down to only having 120 or sometimes up to, I'm sorry, 180 or sometimes up to 270 days left, then they get sent to the county. And it's really just a matter of shifting the cost from the state to the property tax. And so I really appreciate your willingness to reconsider this. Thank you.
Commissioner, are there any questions of the commissioner, or do you?
Well,
Senator Neville.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's always hard sometimes to make apples to apples comparisons, but you said Ramsey County per diem is $95 a day?
That's correct.
Yeah, I think our system-wide corrections department is down in the 70s now.
$66.
Maybe the marginal cost for some of the new beds down in Faribault is going to be down in the 60s. What are you providing that's different from
hot meals?
Well, Mr. Senator, I would just say that might mean that maybe you'd be better off sending them to someplace less expensive. You know, if you look at the cost to the taxpayer.
That might be true, but I'm still curious as to how can you get up to $95 a day?
Commissioner, would you like
what
to
do you do differently?
Take that for
sure.
You. Mr. Chair, if I may, Steve Borkart, Sheriff of Olmsted County, and also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association on this topic. And if I may answer Senator Neville's question, I don't know precisely what the reason for the components that go into that daily per diem in Ramsey County, but I can suggest that it has to do with debt service on new buildings. I think you will find that operational cost is pretty similar. We're all buying a meal for about the same money. We're all paying line-level custodial staff about the same money. And the big difference from county to county is whether or not some counties factor in heat and lights, or whether or not that's paid for as a part of a contiguous county building, and they haven't factored it in as a square footage number, and whether or not they factor in their debt service. And Ramsey, I believe, is sitting on a brand-new facility with probably a brand-new big bond issue to service. So that's my guess.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sure our cost would probably be over 100 if we put debt service on our inmates. Do you know if your number includes medical? Is that 95? It probably does.
Mr. Chris Crutchfield is here from, he's the deputy director of our corrections department. Do you know, Chris?
I don't know, we can find out.
We pay the medical.
We can find out.
Maybe this is more of a generic, Mr. Chair, a generic question that anybody could answer, but for the short-term offenders that are staying at the county level now, does the state still cover their medical care?
Yes.
Okay, because I saw that the bill is still taking 20% out to continue doing that. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Turner can add some to that.
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, the state pays inpatient medical care. So if they're hospitalized, the state will pick it up. And the statute allows for up to 20% of the appropriation to be used for medical care. After I did the summary here where I explained that this would pay for $56 a day after backing out the 20%, I did call the Department of Corrections, and I found out that inpatient medical care is way, way below the ceiling. In 05, it was $30,000 statewide. In 06, it was $77,000 statewide, and that's way below the 20% ceiling of $240,000. So I would imagine if the bill were to pass as it is, the reimbursement would be up more towards about $66 a day as opposed to $56, because I don't think that the inpatient medical costs are going to be 20%. In fact, I know they aren't.
But the Mr. Chairman, Mr. Turner, the outpatient charges are still go with the inmate to the county then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, that's correct.
Is that covered under medical assistance?
Oh, no.
It's not. Okay, so the county actually has to pick up if there's just a doctor visit. But if there's hospitalization, then the state picks it up.
I think I'm getting reimbursed on medical costs.
State pays for all
of it?
Well, the state pays for all of it?
Not just inpatient.
Even if it's not inpatient?
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, I believe in Olmsted County we're being reimbursed for all medical costs, not just inpatient. In fact, as this program has developed over the last 4 years, that is one area that I have to give a DOC credit for managing well. They've been a good partner with respect to medical costs. Okay. In fact, if somebody needs to have prolonged hospitalization, they have taken that detainee back into their system, even though they're a short-term offender. So that piece has worked quite well.
Commissioner Parker, when municipalities have prisoners that are housed then in the county workhouse, they are charged, aren't they, for that cost?
I believe they are. Chris, do we charge municipalities? The 95?
Yes.
When we house, yes.
And what is the rate then that the municipalities pay?
Do you know the rate they pay? Also, we had some discussion with the federal government.
Could you read for the tape? What his answer was?
Mr. Crutchfield thought that it was about $55 a day, but he can check on that. We had some discussions with the federal government, who was interested in using some of our bed space, and they were talking about paying us $85 to $95 a day.
Senator Neville?
Mr. Chair, is there anyone from corrections here today? No? Because I think we're still leasing beds from Appleton as well. And I'm trying to get my memory refreshed on what we're paying there. Last I heard, it was about $55 a day. And what's the difference? I suppose if the cost is the same, it's better to keep them local than to send them all the way out to Appleton. But I'd like to get that number.
Okay. Maybe Mr. Turner can get that for us. Then I believe we have one more sheriff to talk to us about this.
Actually, we have two, and I'll be real quick because I've already been speaking. Again, Steve Borkart, Sheriff of Olmsted County, and also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We support this bill. We like this bill, and I also have with me Pat Maduri, the Sheriff of Itasca County. Give you a tour from the southeast corner of the state to the northern part of the state. And so we can illustrate that it's the same issue for all of us. In Olmsted County, when the program began, we were told that we should average about 8 STOs. And, in fact, we averaged somewhere between 12 and 15, and it has grown each and every year since then. As of today, my jail administrator told me that we're at about 25. But if I take an average of just 16 over those 4 years, our cost has been in the neighborhood, conservatively speaking, county cost has been in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. And I'm very comfortable with that number, with the arithmetic I did, because I was very conservative with the estimates. That number would buy me, that's almost $500,000 a year. That would buy me almost 5 patrol deputies each and every year. So it has had a real cost in terms of being detrimental to our ability to provide services other places. I guess I'll leave it at that. You've heard all the other reasons that I think apply, and I'll turn it over to Sheriff Maduri.
Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pat Maduri, Itasca County Sheriff, third largest county in the state. We have a 107-bed facility, and we've been averaging on a per-day basis approximately 10 short-term offenders since the program started in 2003. Our cost per housing those inmates is approximately $60, just a little over $60 and some change. As Sheriff Borkard said, there's no debt service in there, and there's no heat and lights because we're part of the courthouse complex, so that's not taken into account. Based on my figures, since 2003, it's approximately $870,000 to our local taxpayers for the average of those 10 in Itasca County. With that said, last year, January, February, and March, we housed out, on an average in those 3 months, 28 inmates to our neighboring county. And taking the average of 10 per day of the short-term offenders, again, you can see the impact. Those 28 that we averaged out in those 3 months cost us $50 a day to our neighboring county. So, again, this does have an impact to the local counties, and appreciate any support that you can give this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I have a question, I guess, for our testifiers. Do you get both male female and juvenile offenders coming back on the short term basis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we do not get juveniles, but both males and females, and very reduced number of females, mostly males.
Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Neville.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to get some more information, perhaps from the counties, on this. I certainly support more than $10 a day. That's not fair to the counties. I think the governor was proposing to go up to $30 a day. But on the other hand, going up to, as the bill sits now, it could be more than $60 a day. I just wonder what impact that will have on how judges make their decisions on probation violations or, mostly probation violations, where if they violate the person and commit them, they know that the full cost will come back to the county, as opposed to maybe I'm suggesting something that just doesn't exist, but the judges actually think about who's going to pay the bill when they send somebody to jail or prison. But there's no incentive to keep a person on probation, because if they keep them on probation and maybe just give them a little bit of short jail sentence, then it's all on the county's dime if it's an extra month or so. If they violate them and commit them to the commissioner and then they're short-termers and they leave them in the county that way, then the state picks up 100% of the tab, at least under this bill. So I'm wondering whether that dynamic is just theoretical or whether it might actually come to practice when you have county attorneys suggesting to judges, judge, if you violate him and send him, he'll still be here at the county, but then we don't have to pick up the bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, I'll take a shot at that one. I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think anything like that has happened to date. Conversely, we could say that given that we were going to pick up the majority of the bill for 6 months and under, we could have pulled the string on some of these violators when they still had 2 years left and got them out of the county at state expense. And that hasn't been happening over the last 4 years either. So I don't think judges really look at who's paying when they decide whether or not to violate somebody. I will suggest that this is an unusual population for us. These folks are not getting violated just one time. These are folks that have been getting violated repeatedly, and they've been being put back out on restructured probation terms. And now they're at a point that, in spite of the fact that there's less than 6 months left, the judge just wants to spank them. And there just isn't much left to do but be able to revoke that probation and revoke the stay of execution and make them do at least a little bit of hard time that's left, which is why they become a little bit of a management challenge for us. Normally, somebody that has 6 months or less left to do with us, who's been with us a year, particularly as they get down to the last 2 or 3 months, we're looking to segue them back out into the community with sequentially greater forms of freedom through our sentence to service program, which is supervised work program, and then out to work release, and get them as prepared as possible to be reintegrated. With this population, they're there just to get punished with some straight time because they've been out in the community violating repeatedly. And so it's a different population in that regard. But to get back to your question specifically, I'm not going to say it couldn't happen, but I would suggest it'd be very much a rarity because it hasn't happened in the converse, to my knowledge, in the last 4 years.
Sheriff, a follow-up question on that, kind of related. Have you had any experience with offenders when they're initially charged delaying their legal proceedings so that by the time the case gets resolved, they're under the time period for referral to the state prison and they know they're going to end up in the county workhouse?
Mr. Chair, members, I have no knowledge of such a thing happening. It might be a public defender tactic, but it's not something I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have experience with that. And yes, it is Sheriff Borkert, a public defender tactic, especially if they know the time is there, they'll delay the case out until it gets into that magical window. Then they'll end up doing their time locally. So it does happen. At least I've seen it in our county.
Who pays for that then, Does the county pick up all of that then, or is there at least
until
a state component to that?
Until they're committed, I assume the county does.
Well, the
pre-conviction.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if they're committed to the state, they're actually committed to the state, but ultimately they come to us because they're a short-term offender. So we pay, and then we get reimbursed from the state that $9, $10, $11, $12, whatever it equates out to be. It just prevents them from going to the prison system and then ultimately coming back. It's just a delay, and ultimately they're in our facility.
How about pre-conviction, if they're not yet committed to the state system? Is the county picking up all the costs of that?
Yes.
Any other questions, Senator Foley?
Mr. Chairman and members, what I'm concerned about is the thing that came earlier as to the figures of cost of various things. And I do know that the Corrections Department has some reentry programs and dealing with issues like that, also dealing with the people that have drug problems and alcohol, if you include that separately, deal with that. Is that do you have any programs, Sheriff Barker, that deal with the those offenders that are in your jails?
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, yes, we do. That doesn't necessarily mean that this population of short-term offenders is a population that can take advantage of a lot of that programming. We typically, the detainee that gets the most value out of that is one that is with us for the better part of a year, obviously. The state will argue, the DOC will argue that it makes more sense to keep these people locally rather than sending them to St. Cloud, going through an orientation process, never really getting out into the main population before they have to come back. But in fact, in our situation, it's largely the same too, because they're not going to be participating in a reintegration project the same way that one of our own people that was sentenced to less than a year would be participating due to the fact that they're being punished. And that being said, there may be some efficiencies in keeping up the local level. Then it just becomes the cost shift burden of keeping somebody that was originally supposed to be the cost of the Commissioner of Corrections being shifted to the local level to the tune of, like in my situation, from a range anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 per year of additional expense.
Senator Higgins, do you have an idea, or maybe does staff have any idea what the fiscal note would be if the state paid for all of the costs of its prisoners that are housed in local facilities?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Schirmer can help us with that.
He'll never get paid all.
If it's the state's responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, members,
I guess the question, what's the cost of the unfunded mandate overall that we're forcing on the counties?
We have, when we first wrote the legislation, was it 4 years ago now, we put a ceiling of $70 per day on, which we thought was reasonable. This bill would fund $70 a day for 300 offenders over 365 days. So this would be the unfunded mandate, the bill that Senator Higgins is carrying. And that would come out to an additional $6.5 million a year. On top of the $1.2 million in corrections base they have for reimbursements now.
So the 300 offenders is the approximate number of state prisoners total statewide that are being housed in county facilities now?
Mr. Chairman, that's according to the Department of Corrections, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have Keith Carlson here from the Association of Counties, MICA, who I know had something passed out, and I believe he wants to talk to us as well.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I don't want to belabor the points that have already been made. I just want to reinforce the fact that this is a clear cost shift to counties under the current law, costing us nearly $19 million in the 4 years that it's been in effect, and using the Department of Corrections average per diem of $81 a day is saving them $7.7 million a year and is costing us the same amount. One thing I do want to address is some misconceptions that I think have come from the administration. First, this proposal was not put into effect because county jails had a surplus of space. As you've already heard, many of us are facing the same shortages as the state has suffered over the most recent time span. But not only does it cost us by the beds that we have to provide for these individuals, in many cases, because of our shortages, we're having to lease space at other facilities, and in addition to that cost, paying for the transport of those individuals from our facility to another facility. In the instance of Dakota County, for example, they're transporting prisoners right now as far away as Wilmer. That takes the patrol deputy off the streets of the county, spending time instead on transporting that individual the nearly 100 miles to and then from those facilities where those individuals are. The last point I want to address is the suggestion that it's perhaps more appropriate to place these individuals in our facilities rather than in the state's facilities. I want to make it clear that we're not talking about petty misdemeanors, or gross misdemeanors. We're talking about felons, and we're talking about felons that have had, as has already been stated, multiple bites at the apple by a judge who has granted a downward departure in the initial sentencing and consequently, instead of sending them to state prison, has put them either on probation or a combination of some time in local jail and then probation. And they've simply failed to abide by the terms of that probation. We've already seen them by the time that they subsequently have their probation revoked or their supervised, in some other instances, supervised release revoked several times. And frankly, the threat of jail time simply is not working with that individual. On the last two pages of my presentation, I just show the current sentencing guidelines. The white side of the grid are those individuals who are currently under the sentencing guidelines presumed to be committed to prison. And obviously you can see that they're within the sexual offender grid, those who have committed first and second degree criminal sexual conduct crimes. And then on the other portion of the grid for the other crimes, those who have committed primarily crimes against persons. The Department of Corrections, I believe, has made the suggestion that we're primarily talking about drug offenders. Fact of the matter is that under the most recent report from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, there were downward departures from those who were presumptively committed under the guidelines to prison over one-third of the time, 34.7% in 2005, the most recent data. And those individuals, less than half of them were drug offenders and individuals who had committed assaults in the second degree, which means that they cover the gamut of all these other offenses. These are serious offenders, people that, frankly, don't go into our facilities very well. It creates a substantial safety risk for us that we have to manage by putting them into our existing inmate population, and also creates a security risk. So I urge you to support Senator Higgins' bill and also endorse Senator Olsen's legislation, too. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson? Senator Neville?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, I'm very familiar with the sentencing guideline grid, but do you have some charts that actually show the breakdown of these 300 or so offenders who would be short-term offenders? You know, where do they fall in the grid? Because it strikes me that, you know, obviously some of them are stays of execution, but most of those, if they're sex offenders, are still going to have a fairly, you know, more than 12 months, and they would go to the state if it's executed. It strikes me that most of them are going to be relatively low-level felons, aren't they? But I'm just guessing. I'd like to see the breakdown. You know, we might have a policy concern if most of these short-term offenders are sex offenders, as opposed to just thieves and burglars, maybe we'd want to change the short-term policy anyway. But I've never really seen a breakdown of what the offenses are that these 300 people that are staying at the county level.
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville.
Senator Higgins.
I had a conversation with a woman who works at the Hennepin County Workhouse, and she works in the reentry part, and she works most days with one of the murderers who's there. And, you know, frankly, I didn't think the workhouse was a place for murderers, but he's there. And I will, she's out of town, I believe, right now, but I will ask her if she can get us more of a breakdown for what the population is at Hennepin County, and maybe maybe Commissioner Parker can do the same for Ramsey, and Mr. Carlson can help us get that information from the other counties. I'd be really interested to know that, too.
Well, and Mr. Chair, the corrections ought to know who these folks are, too. I mean, even if they never get to the prison, they're being committed to the commissioner, so the commissioner should have, or the Sentencing Guideline Commission, ought to have those numbers of what the offenses are for those 300 or so people. But the other thing is, just now, you know, this is obviously going to be mostly a finance question in terms of once your target is set and how much we can afford to give to the counties. But from a policy point of view, to the extent this is a policy committee, I'm not sure we should, as sympathetic as I am to the counties, you know, $10 is totally inadequate. Maybe 30, which is what the governor's proposing, is inadequate to create the right equilibrium, if you will, between the counties and the state. But I don't know that we should be going to 55 either. You know, I'm kind of thinking as a policy decision, maybe $40 is kind of the right equilibrium, because, I mean, this whole system can frankly be manipulated from a financial point of view. I mean, part of the manipulation is to keep your, if you're a public defender, keep your guy, don't bail out. Let him stay in jail for 60 or 90 days before the trial, and then you get credit for that, and then you get less than 6 months to go, and you know you're not going to have to go to the prison. Part of the thing might be that the judges know what their jail capacity and population is, and they'll take that into account in the back of their head when they decide whether to execute the sentence or not. So there's a partnership between the counties and the state, and I think it should be somewhere between $30 and $55 from a policy point of view.
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner Parker?
Senator Neville, I was just told by our staff person that the Department of Corrections' current policy, if they were going to be leasing space from us, which sometimes they have to do, their current policy is $55 a day.
Okay. I'm not surprised by that.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to respond to some of Senator Neville's queries. I agree with Senator Higgins and Commissioner Parker. We will try and get you more definitive information on the short-term offenders. I just want to point out one possible misconception here. We keep on referring to 300. That's 300 beds. The actual number of individuals we're talking about is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 a year. So it's a much larger universe in terms of people that we're talking about vis-a-vis the beds that determine these expenses.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understood that it's basically full-time equivalents or annualized. Yeah.
That's good, because I didn't.
Senator Engelbretson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. Commissioner, you said earlier that the municipalities pay the counties for housing prisoners. Is that accurate? At least out in the rural areas, I don't think it is. I don't think they ever have. If they're charged under state statute, I think it's still the county's responsibility. Is that accurate?
Mr. Senator, I was told that we do charge municipalities, but we need to check on that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I know in Hennepin County, it's common practice if the city of St. Louis Park charges out under a state statute, a misdemeanor offense, and that person's convicted and goes to the county workhouse, City of St. Louis Park is paying the county as part of the time, and I think that's common practice in Hennepin County anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's anybody else here who wants to speak for the bill.
Is there anybody else here who wants to speak to this bill?
If not, I'll move that Senate File 417, is that right? 417, laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Bill's laid over.
Sure, thank you.
There being no other business set before the committee today, we are adjourned.